Yeah, so let me start by saying it's a pleasure to be here and thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to talk about my work here. I want to quickly add to that that I hope that the organizers were also right in thinking that you were interested in my work, because at the talk by Toby Weissman, I became painfully aware of the fact that I was in none of the four groups this workshop is bringing together.
Maybe a cult of gratitude.
Well, someone wants to adopt me. Okay, that's. Well, no, I sort of see myself as a Connors Matter physicist, although there are probably also Connors Matter physicists that want to refuse that. at least that's the, for me, the motivation of my work comes from that field. But as you will hopefully see throughout the talk, that there are some similarities between the things that you are doing and the things that I'm doing. And because I don't know your field or the things that you are particularly interested in, well, I will not try to draw parallels, so I hope that you will just notice them yourself, and if you have questions or comments or anything, please interrupt me. So, I mean, we might have some barrier in understanding each other, so questions can be helpful then. So before I start, I'd like to acknowledge my supervisor back in Amsterdam, who I did my PhD with, Cameron Schoutens, who is also the founding father of this model that I'll be talking about together with Paul Kennedy and Jan de Boer, who is missing. But so this is basically a list of my collaborators. In the past and also still ongoing work at the moment. Right, so let me start with what for me is the motivation to look at this model. In condensed matter physics, the main challenge is to understand strongly interacting fermions. And some key examples of systems that require understanding of such systems are the high-TC superconductors and the heavy fermion compounds. And you don't need to know anything of these systems except for the fact that they are studied experimentally quite well and they exhibit a very complicated phase diagram. And to understand this phase diagram, we really need to understand strongly interacting electrons. And the theory here is really lagging far behind the experiments. And that's mainly because the conventional techniques used in condensed matter physics simply do not apply here. And I'll come back to that in a couple of slides. But so, sort of the standard approach in condensed matter physics is to study a lattice model, where I quickly want to add that in our case, time is continuous. So a lattice model is a spatial lattice, which arises naturally because we study solid state systems where the molecules crystallize and the ions form a potential background landscape for the valence electrons to move around in. And because this is, of course, taking into account all these particles is way too difficult, so we strip the problem and we just, the only thing that we keep from these ions is their background potential. And that is this lattice that I picked here. And then there are electrons, valence electrons, that move around in that lattice. And typically, we can describe this by a Hamiltonian, which contains kinetic terms for these particles to hop, and then short-range interaction terms. Now, the most famous lattice model in condensed matter physics is the Hubbard model, which was written down a long time ago already, and it's very simple to write down. It's the Coulomb repulsion is taken into account only as an on-site repulsion. So we consider electrons with spin, and their creation and annihilation operators obey the usual anti-commutation relation, where sigma denotes the spin. And there's a nearest neighbor hopping, a kinetic term, and the hopping parameter is usually written as T. And then there's an energy penalty if two particles sit on the same side. And they can only do so if they have opposite spin, of course, due to Pauli's exclusion. Now, this model looks very simple, but it turns out that it's already exhibits quite a rich phase diagram. And here I show sort of the two limits of the model that are more or less understood. So there's, of course, a low density regime where everything is dominated by kinetics. And these electrons will just behave as a Fermi liquid. And there's a high density regime, which is dominated by the interactions. And the system is believed to go into an insulating phase, which is called the Mott insulator. And this is sort of a cartoon picture of this phase. This structure already has similarities with the cuprate, which is one of the most famous examples of a high DC superconductor. And there's reason to think that this model maybe describes cuprates and high DC superconductivity. However, to really know whether that is true, we need to access this intermediate density regime. So the cuprates go superconducting when you start to dope the system, which is effectively taking out the electrons and going to lower densities. And at some intermediate doping, you can see superconductivity. But it's very difficult to access this intermediate regime because then we have to treat the kinetics and the interaction terms on equal footing. And so perturbative tools will not work. So this is really the challenge. And conventional techniques such as mean field, which relies heavily on the possibility to do perturbation theory, is typically unreliable. A technique that works very well in one dimension, beta ansatz, which also works for strong interactions, doesn't work in higher dimensions. And then, as you well know, quantum Monte Carlo suffers from the sign problem for this type of problem. So this is really an extremely difficult problem, and by no means do I want to pretend that I make any sort of significant progress in this direction, but I just want to sketch this problem to make sure that you agree with me that this is a very hard problem, and that it justifies some extreme measures that I'm about to take. So instead of this way too hard problem, what I'm going to do is simplify it quite a bit and make some adjustments, and then also incorporate supersymmetry. And what this allows me to do is obtain exact results for a strongly interacting system in more than two dimensions, really in the non-perturbative regime. And so let's see. So of course supersymmetry plays a key role here, and I guess that's also the reason why you might be interested in this model. So what is the model that we'll study? We have a hardcore spinless fermions. So we've dropped the spin. So that's a major simplification that we make. But furthermore, we consider them to have such a repulsion that they will not even occupy neighboring sites. So of course, since they're spinless, they cannot occupy the same site due to Pauli exclusion. But we will also send a potential term for particles being nearest neighbors to infinity. So we won't allow this type of configurations either. And there will be hopping, nearest neighbor hopping, which obeys this constraint. So hopping to this site where the neighboring site is occupied will not occur. Now, for this model, we can sort of make somewhat simpler phase diagram as for the Hubbard model, but at low densities, we'll probably have something like Fermi liquid again. And for high densities, we'll get a sort of trivial insulating phase, where these particles are just all stuck because they can't move because of this hardcore constraint. And it was shown by handing it all, that's once you dope this system, you get a sort of a stripe-like face where there's there's two types of order here in this insulating phase, and you get sort of regimes of the different types of order upon small doping. But now if we incorporate supersymmetry in this model, we will be able to study this intermediate density regime.
So this stripe phase appears only if you have this simplification?
Yeah, it's precisely for this model. Just hopping and this this exclusion.
Uh-huh. And supersymmetry is also possible in this part.
Yeah. So at this moment we don't have supersymmetry yet, but I'll define shortly how we get it. Right. So before I go into the details, what I want to do is show you that the benefit of incorporating supersymmetry in this model is twofold. So first of all, it will supply us with some very powerful tools to study this model. But maybe more interesting and more unexpected, it turns out that this model has some really exotic features. Because there turns out to be a subtle interplay between the kinetic terms and the interaction terms that lead to things as quantum criticality and something that we call super frustration. Which is, super frustration is characterized by an extensive ground state entropy. But you will hear all about that in this talk. So first I'll first define the model and discuss some basics of supersymmetry. And then I'll sort of, via the tools that we get, show you what kind of features that we can reveal of this model. And then in the end I'll end with conclusions and some recent development. Right, so the supersymmetry that we discuss is just a quantum mechanical supersymmetry. And it's defined in terms of the supercharges. So there are two supercharges, Q plus and Q minus. And Q minus is the Hermitian conjugate of Q plus. And there's a fermion number. And these the supercharges are nilpotent. They square to zero. And they have this commutation relation with the fermion number operator. And so this tells you that Q plus adds a fermionic degree of freedom to the system, and Q minus takes out a fermionic degree of freedom. And then, once we have this structure, we define the Hamiltonian as the anticommutator of Q plus and Q minus. And so from that, it immediately follows that the Hamiltonian commutes with all these operators. Now, imposing this structure, as you well know, has some immediate consequences for the spectrum. So first of all, all the energies are positive definite, so there are no negative energy states. Furthermore, all states with a positive energy come in doublets. And you can choose to write them like this. So if a state psi is annihilated by Q minus and it has some positive energy, there will be a state Q plus that has the same energy. And this state is the superpartner of the state psi. Finally, a state has zero energy if and only if it's a singlet under the Susi algebra, so it's annihilated both by Q plus and Q minus. Now, in high energy physics, this is a symmetry between bosonic and fermionic particles, but as I said in the beginning, we will study spinless fermions on the lattice, and there are no bosons. So in this case, the symmetry will be between many particle states, where the fermionic state will have an odd number of fermions, and the bosonic state has an even number of fermions. So now we have to specify what these superchargers are to get a lattice model. So we will define a Q plus to be a sum over all sides of the creation operator of a spinless fermion times a projection operator. So this is a product over all the neighboring sides of I, of 1 minus nj, and where nj is the number operator. So for these spinless fermions, it's either 1 or 0. And so it's 1 if the side j is occupied, and in that case, the particle is not created on the side I. And q minus is just the Hermitian conjugate. And so now the Hamiltonian is the anticommutator of q plus and q minus. And for the example of that the lattice is a one-dimensional chain, it turns out that working out this anticommutator, you find this Hamiltonian. So what you see here is nearest neighbor hopping, but in such a way that this next nearest neighbor exclusion nearest neighbor exclusion is obeyed. So you will only hop from side I plus 1 to side I, given that the neighboring side is empty. And then there's a next nearest neighbor repulsion term, and there's a chemical potential term and a constant. And so this is not the Hubbard model, of course, but for a condensed matter physicist, this is not so problematic. I mean, there's some things that you don't like, of course. One is the fact that all the parameters have to be tuned to a certain value to have the supersymmetry. So if I just change the chemical potential, then I lose the fact that I wrote the Hamiltonian like this, so I can't do that. But what I can do is I can put this Hamiltonian on any lattice that I want. And so in general, it will look like this. There will always be a nearest neighbor hopping term, and there will be an interaction term or diagonal piece, and its details will depend on the lattice that we choose. So we're here, I've introduced this protection operator in this way. And
this looks for any lattice, by what size or not?
Yes, it can work on any lattice. And so this is something that I'll be doing throughout the talk, is I'll show you different lattices and show you that the model can behave very differently for different lattices.
What is the Hilbert space? It's one degree per site, or?
The Hilbert space is the space spent by configurations of spinless fermions, such that no two of these fermions are ever nearest neighbor.
So there's no bosonic partners?
No, so the bosonic part are all the configurations that have an even number of fermions. That's what I would call bosonic space, or the bosonic Hilbert. Okay, so here's actually an example of a six-side chain. And these are the possible configurations. So this is exactly your question. This is the Hilbert space. So this is the empty chain. And I call this the state zero, so the vacuum. But don't be confused. The vacuum is not the lowest energy state. So that's something important. I mean, it's not really the vacuum, it's just empty, no particles. But and then there are six configurations with one particle that I create out of this empty state by acting with the creation operator of the spinless fermion. Then there are nine possible configurations to have two particles in such a way that you don't violate this nearest neighbor constraint. And finally, there are two configurations with three particles. And that's it. I can't go to four particles without violating this system.
As you evolve this in time, is it in principle possible to populate any site, or are there some sites that you'll never be able to reach?
No, you can populate any site. I mean, you can't go outside this Hilbert space.
Right, but I'm figuring out this exclusion, so it's not for me. So eventually you can put some fermion on any site.
Yeah.
It will happen.
Yeah, yes.
Why can't you have two particles?
No, so I must, dependent on the initial state, for an arbitrary initial state, this will happen. You start from an initial state like this, or one of them. It's still true that for any.
Well, okay.
Can you use the number?
No, no, the number of dots, but can you put a dot, a green thing on anybody?
Okay, so what is conserved is the number of particles. So indeed, in this sector, that will happen. This particle can just go everywhere. Mm-hmm. But if I start in this sector, so here there's no dynamics. From this...
Okay, so this is flows.
Yes. Yeah.
What stops you from having two particles in opposite corners?
You mean one particle here and one particle? Nothing. That is allowed. So that is included in these nine possibilities.
But it wouldn't fit that formula.
No.
Okay.
No, so this is just to, this is this configuration. Or, yeah. Okay, so for this six-side chain, the spectrum looks like this. And what you see is that it looks manifestly supersymmetric in the way that I just told you. So there are no negative energy states. There are zero energy states, which are singlets. And all the positive energy states can be paired with their superpartners. And so what you see here is that the lowest energy states are actually realized in the sector with two particles. So this was what I denoted as a vacuum, but it's not the lowest energy state. Okay, so let's go to the first and the, sort of the easiest tool that we have available now that we incorporated supersymmetry, which is the Witten index. So the Witten index is defined as the trace over minus 1 to the power nf, where nf counts the number of fermions in these states, and the trace is over the entire Hilbert space. And because of the supersymmetric structure, all the bosonic states contribute plus 1, and the fermionic states contribute minus 1, and so all these superpartners work cancel out in this trace. And the only states that contribute are the zero energy states. And so in particular, the Witten index will turn out to be the number of bosonic ground states minus the number of fermionic ground states. And so in this example, I expect the Witten index to be 2. So let's check that that's the case. Oh yeah, and so the absolute value, the Witten index is a lower bound to the number of ground states. So in this example, we simply carry out this trace, and so the empty state contributes this plus 1, the 6 states with one particle contribute minus 6, plus 9 minus 2 is 2. And so the nice thing here is that we don't have to diagonalize the Hamiltonian, which is what we usually have to do if we want to find the ground state, or at least the number of ground states. We just had to do this purely combinatorial exercise to find that we will have two lowest energy states. Okay. So.
But what are these lowest energy states?
What they are?
Yes.
Which of them?
What is the mixture?
So they have particle number 2, but they turn out to be both complicated superpositions of these nine possible states with two particles. So they don't have some sort of trivial form.
Is there any topological reason to be that Witten index is equal to 2? Some topological aspect on the lattice?
In a way, there is. It will turn out that it's 2 if the number of sites is a multiple of 3. So I think this can be related to topology in some way, but we will see in more detail how these things go. Okay, so the chain was sort of trivial, of course. Anyone could do that. So now let's look at the triangular lattice. So I have doubly periodic boundary conditions on the triangular lattice, and computed this Witten index in precisely in the way that I showed on the previous slide, but on the computer, of course. And then you see this sort of bizarre structure arise. Because remember that the absolute value of these numbers here is the lower bound to the number of ground states. So as the lattice grows, the number of ground states increases and increases. And in fact, if you analyze this data a little bit,
there is no zero.
Yes, correct. There's no zero.
Now, on the triangular lattice, they would be frustrated anyway. Even the Hubbard model would be frustrated. Put things down in any way to get unique ground state, right?
On the triangular lattice, you typically have frustration if you have spins. But we don't have spins here, but we have a funny Hilbert space. So yeah. So if you fit to this data.
The periodic boundary condition, you mean literally periodic in the three different directions, or just the spins?
It's a two-dimensional lattice.
And the question is, the tau parameter of the periodicity is such that you have the threefold symmetry, the sixfold symmetry is preserved by the boundary conditions or not?
Yes, I think. So, it is really this lattice, and if I have n equals 2,
so if you just
3, then identify these.
If you're not careful, you will break the sixfold symmetry to a fourfold symmetry, for example.
Okay.
I don't know to what. You'll break it completely. So I just mean the definition of periodic boundary.
Yeah, so the definition is that I identify the particle or the sites here with these sites here and sites here with the sites on the system.
Yeah, that breaks. So you have no more any crystallographic symmetry, is that correct?
I haven't really thought about that, but I guess that's correct, yeah.
But you could have preserved it if you compactified nice, you made a torus of a hexagon.
I see.
But then there's no arbitrary N and M, there's only one. Yeah.
But you have a guaranteed symmetry, so you can diagonalize with a subset. There's an operator.
Which doesn't
It does not want to diagonalize.
Oh, okay, that's definitely interesting point. Consider what happens there.
I'm just curious because of all these funny numbers. I want to know whether.
Yeah.
So there's no more things. Thank you.
So what we see is that this number grows exponentially with the number of sites in the system. So, and that this is only the lower bound to the number of ground. And it turns out that the triangular lattice is not the only lattice to exhibit this. In fact, we sort of typically see this behavior. So here's two more examples where I have now V is denotes the number of sites, as in the volume of the system, 2D volume. So also the hexagonal lattice has this exponential growth, and the Martini lattice as well.
It's just by having an algorithm that goes around and populates the, it just enumerates all possible.
Yeah, so you do it with the transfer matrix.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so I should acknowledge Hendrik van Eerte did actually these numerical computations before I even started my PhD. Okay, so what this tells us is that there's some sort of frustration in the system going on. So frustration typically arises when you have competing terms in the Hamiltonian, and this is the key example that Simon already alluded to. So you have an antiferromagnet on a triangular lattice, and then the spins want to be antiparallel, and the third spin doesn't know which bond to satisfy. And so there's more than one lowest energy state. But here in this supersymmetric case, it turns out that it's not just geometric frustration, there's sort of a really subtle interplay between kinetic and potential terms. And so typically this leads to this exponential ground state degeneracy. And that is a violation of the third law of thermodynamics, which tells us that as we lower the temperature, the entropy per site should go to zero, which in this case it does.
Why not call this a spin glass?
Yeah.
in a spin glass, you sort of have a potential landscape, and you could imagine that there is a sort of one global minimum, I guess, right? But you get stuck in all kinds of sort of local minima. Whereas here, the ground state is really exactly degenerate. And it's also quantum mechanical. So we don't start from just a classical potential length. Okay, so sort of a qualitative understanding of the frustration goes under the name of the three rule, which says that if we just study the interactions of this model, then these favor the particles to sit three sides apart, but because we have a hardcore constraint for particles to be nearest neighbors, there's a potential interaction, an energy penalty for them to be two sides apart, but three sides apart, that's fine. But then, because of the and the chemical potential favors us to be at higher and higher density. So optimally, they would sit three sides apart, but it turns out that once you include also the kinetics, that there's actually lots of ways where these particles can sit sort of three sides apart and minimize the energy. And so this also tells us that this frustration occurs at intermediate densities. So so far, we've only seen that we have this number of ground states, but I haven't told you, and the Witten index doesn't tell us at which densities these ground states occur. So that's a nice bridge to the next part, because cohomology can tell us where these ground states occur. So the cohomology of Q, I'll define it on the next slide, but it turns out that there's a one-to-one correspondence between zero energy states, ground states, and the cohomology elements of this supercharge Q. This thing is a lot more difficult to compute than the Witten index, but still it's simpler than diagonalizing the Hamiltonian, and it also gives a lot more information. So it gives us the total number of ground states, not just the lower bound, and it tells us what the number of fermions in the state is, and it turns out that it often also gives an interpretation of these ground states in terms of a geometric object. Okay, so the cohomology is defined the cohomology at a certain fermion number is defined as the kernel of Q plus at that fermion number divided out over the image of Q plus at one fermion number less. Right, so this makes sense. The maybe this is completely trivial to you. I don't know how often, but so the ground states are in the kernel of Q plus, right? They are annihilated by Q plus, that we know. But they are also orthogonal to the image of Q plus, because if they were in the image of Q plus, then they would have a superpartner, and we know that superpartners have a positive energy. Right, and so this denotes the complex of Q plus. The Hilbert space is a graded vector space. Okay, so I won't go into any of the details of how we compute the cohomology, but in some cases we can do it. And so here is this Witten index table for the square lattice, and so this really looks quite remarkable. So there's lots of ones, and then there's also growing numbers. And this table is actually mostly understood. By computing the cohomology. So this cohomology of Q turns out to give a direct relation between these ground states and rhombus tilings. So these are the four tiles that are allowed to form a tiling, and the number of tiles is in one-to-one correspondence with the number of fermions. And so if I have the square lattice, I put periodic boundary conditions, wrap it on a torus, and I try to make all the possible tilings on that torus, then I find that the number of ground states is exactly equal to the number of tilings that I was able to make. And the number of particles corresponds exactly to the number of tiles that I...
But the tiles are the corners. So are the particles located in the corners or in the center of the tile?
Well, neither actually. But so the so I compute the cohomology, and it turns out that this problem of computing the cohomology can be mapped. Eventually, I can map every non-trivial element of the cohomology to a tiling. And so basically, it's just a counting tool. All that it does for me is count. And but of course, it's very tempting to try and see these tilings as ground states. So yeah, the sort of the zeroth order approximation of a ground state could be that you put the particles on the corners of the tile. But before I'll say a little bit about this, let me just say what this implies. So first of all, it tells us that there are zero energy states in this range of fillings. So between 1/5 filling, which would correspond to a completely green tiling where I only use the squares, and a 1/4 filling, which is a completely red tiling.
The number of tiles is the same independent of the lattice?
No, you can put any tiling and use as many tiles that, sorry, you can use as many tiles as you want as long as you make a nice tiling with no overlaps or gaps. And so it will turn out that you have like different numbers of tiles, and that corresponds to different fillings for the ground state. And so what you should note is that this is really intermediate densities, right? Remember that I started off saying that it's really difficult to get any results at intermediate densities. Well, these particles are free to move around, but they're also close enough to really interact with each other. And it turns out that if you count tilings, that they actually don't give rise to an exponential growth of the number of ground states in the volume, but instead in sort of the perimeter of the system, the linear dimension of the system. So, so I have a ground state entropy that grows with n plus m. So the entropy per side will actually vanish in the thermodynamic lattice for this case. So that's different from the triangular lattice.
How difficult is it to count tilings?
Counting tilings compared to doing the cohomology computation is pretty easy.
But that means the map between this one. I mean, you got to the tiling by mapping it from the cohomology calculation.
Yeah, so I compute.
So it's a very complicated map from one to the other.
Yeah, just had to stare a little before you could see it. Yeah. So the tiling actually was found before the cohomology computation was done because the Witten index problem could be mapped already to this tiling problem, where you have to say put a plus for a tiling with an even number of tiles and a minus for a tiling with an odd number of tiles. So we sort of knew where we had to go. Or at least, so... Yes. Yeah.
But presumably, it's not a new tiling, you can just translate it, right?
After this one.
No.
Yes, that also counts as a new... Yeah, you have
no,
to...
No, translation, so that's part of this linear thing.
Yeah.
Counting it doesn't look very easy.
How do you count them?
Well, so... okay, well, so if you have a torus, what one thing that you will sort of quickly, once you stare at it for a little bit, quickly figure out is that that you will only have to specify one string of tiles in one direction and a string of tiles in the other direction. And once you specify that, then you have no freedom left to fill in the tiling.
That's why it's linear.
Yes.
But there's no such in the triangular lines, the boundary ones. No such. I mean, you just go one by one. It's not like not like a quasi crystal that you can.
No.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, so basically these things I already said, so there's an exponential growth in the linear size, the ground states at intermediate densities, and some other studies that I haven't talked about seem to tell us that there might be edge modes in this system, and also this fact of the loops around the torus suggests that there may be something topological going on. And so this is pure speculation.
What's an edge mode?
An edge mode is a gapless mode that is confined to live on the edge. So if I open the torus into a cylinder, then I have an edge of the system, and I can excite a mode there that has like very small energy, a massless mode, and that will not be able to propagate into the bulk, but has to live on this boundary. And so edge modes are typically seen in quantum Hall systems, for example. So they are typically associated to topological order. And so, well, one thing is what we want to know, of course, is how do we understand the ground state? What do they look like? And so the simplest thing that you can think of is put the particles on the corners of the tiles. But you quickly see that this is not even an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. It doesn't come close. These particles are free to hop around. So this is way too simple. And so maybe something that's going on is that these particles sort of resonate on a tile, that they're action radius is sort of localized to the tiles. It would be very interesting to find out if something like this is true, but that's still an open problem. Okay, so let us see what we can understand of this Witten index table of the triangular lattice. So here it turns out that the cohomology problem could not be tackled so far. It turns out to be quite hard. But there are some intermediate results that already tell us a couple of things. So first of all, an upper bound could be found. And that tells us that at most will the number of ground states grow like this. And furthermore, there was a lower bound on the window of filling. So if you have a big enough system, you will always find zero energy states in this region of filling. So it's again intermediate densities. Finally, for a big enough system, you will never find zero energy states outside this window of filling. So those were results that we were able to obtain. And then we did some numerics to see what that would tell us. And so here is a result on the total number of ground states for the triangular lattice, where there's again a doubly periodic boundary conditions with these sizes. And this is the upper bound, and this is the lower bound that was extracted from the Witten index. Note that it's on a logarithmic plot.
How did you get the load?
Okay, so this was an extracted from the numeric, so asymptotically it should not go below the lowest bound. Of course.
I see. This is asymptotic bound.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
I just saw this one.
So this is the data, and we extracted a fit to this data. Okay, I don't know how accurate that is, but that the total number of ground states will grow, something like this. And we also looked at the filling. So here's the system size along this axis, and the filling along this axis. And the symbols denote the possible filling. So if you're on a lattice, of course you can't reach all fillings. And the black dots are or the filled symbols denote fillings where we found zero energy states. And so these are again the bounds. So outside, below a quarter, an eighth, and above a quarter, we don't expect to find any zero energy states. And indeed, we don't. And it might be that we indeed end up having only zero energy state in this minimum window that was found then. But the numerics is not big enough to really say anything conclusive about this. But maybe what's most well, what I found at least a nice result is that we were also able to resolve for momentum. There's translational invariance along these two directions, and you can look at the eigenvalues of the ground states under those translations, and these eigenvalues take some exponential form, and what I write here is kx and ky. And so we find that, so this is for the 6 by 9 lattice, the total number of ground states is almost 2,000. The Witten index is less than that. So it's really just a lower bound. There are zero energy states at 9 and 10 particles, and they seem to sit at all momenta. So that's what I would call a flat band, or a flat band dispersion. Right? There's no dispersion as a function of momenta.
A question? Do you have examples where the number of ground states is just much larger than the Witten index? Or is the Witten index somehow always a good bound that comes close?
No, so when as soon as you see that there's this window of filling, already tells you that the Witten index has to be a lower bound. Of course, it could be that at all these, right, because in a window of filling there will be bosonic and fermionic states alternating. And so only if in that window of filling all the ground sort of, there's like one ground set at all the fillings, and set at one filling there's a lot, then the Witten index sort of comes close to the total number of ground states. But more typically it will really be a lower bound.
So, excuse me, the numbers there are the numbers of ground states with those momenta?
Yes.
And this doesn't happen with a square lattice?
Yes, with the square lattice that happens as well. Actually there, the tilings can already tell us what the associated momenta are. So the tiling has some unit cell, and that tells you the possible momenta that it takes, or that it corresponds to. Yeah, but so here we don't know that there's a tiling, but okay, maybe this tells you that there is. Okay, so now the last tool that I want to discuss is spectral flow, and it will be sort of switch of gears, because we will go down to one-dimensional lattice. So I started out with a Hamiltonian for the one-dimensional chain. And we did this example of the six-side chain, and we saw that there were two ground states. But it turns out that, in general, when we have a periodic chain, there are two ground states when the length of the chain is a multiple of 3. And there's a unique ground state otherwise. And the number of fermions in that state is the closest number to a third filling. It turns out that on the one-dimensional chain, this model is actually integrable, and there's a beta-ansatz solution. And the continuum limit turns out to be described by an n equals 2,2 superconformal field theory with central charge equal to 1. And so this means that it's gapless, so we'll call that quantum critical, and there's an emergent spacetime supersymmetry here. And this model is related to the XXZ spin chain. And there's actually an exact mapping to that model. And there's a certain value for the anisotropy parameter in that case. And it turns out that this model is also related to the supersymmetric matrix models of Venetiano and Wojcik. And that relation is known, again, via this mapping that exists to the XXZ spin chain. And finally, there's a way to extend this model by allowing k particles to be nearest neighbors, but not k plus 1. And in that case, you have some more parameters that you can tune in your Hamiltonian, but it turns out that if you tune them to a critical point, this critical point is described by the K superconformal minimal model, where this K is related to the K particles that you allow to be next to each other.
This means it downloads the trigger, so. Or the other case.
What is it like in this one?
I'm afraid, I'm not entirely sure. But yeah, so I can look that up for you. I'm not entirely sure.
You said it's exact mapping, so one is.
No, so there's only an exact mapping if for k equals 1. But
no, I asked for k not equal 1.
Yes, and but for k not equal 1, I'm not.
Yeah.
Okay, so in if you want to identify the continuum limit as a conformal field theory in a one-dimensional system, you have a couple of things that you can do numerically. So you can do finite-size scaling of the gap, and then the energy of the first excited state should go down as 1 over L. Another thing that you can study is the entanglement entropy, which should behave as log L, where the there's a universal constant here, which is the central charge. But in these models, we have yet another way to study this, which is by using the fact that there's a spectral flow in superconformal field theory. And that tells you that if you do a boundary twist, the energy will depend parabolically on this twist parameter. And the upshot of this method is that it turns out to be quite accurate for small systems, and there's no scaling required, such as in this case, where you have to compare different system sizes. So let's see this. Okay, so for we checked that this works for the one-dimensional chain where we know what the continuum theory is, so it better work there. So what we do is introduce this boundary term, where if alpha is 0, we just have periodic boundary conditions, whereas when it's a half, we have antiperiodic boundary conditions. And then we look at how the energy depends on this alpha and check that it's parabolic, as the theory predicts. So this is what we get from superconformal field theory. So this is the spectrum of.
Shouldn't it be even in alpha? What makes you differentiate between the twist and this way and this way? Maybe I missed it.
Oh, no.
You have a linear.
Yes. So that has to do with momentum. So the vacuum indeed is even, but it will. I think it will be a little bit more clear when you see the example. But it's definitely even around the vacuum. So this is the spectrum of this of a 27 side chain with 9 particles. So there here are the 2 zero energy states. And for the trained eye, you already see sort of a conformal tower above the lowest energy state. And if instead I take antiperiodic boundary conditions, it looks like this. And so now, when I have antiperiodic boundary conditions, I have broken the exact supersymmetric form of the Hamiltonian. So I do have a state here below zero energy now. And this is the actual Neveu-Schwarz vacuum. And so if I do this for different values of alpha and I plot everything in the same plot, so the black spectrum that I showed you first is still here, and then there are the red dots, and well, every color corresponds to a different twist operator. And then you can see that this nicely, these levels flow nicely on a parabola. I hope that the.
At least alpha equals pi is a symmetric part.
Yes. Yeah. But yeah, so this of course, if I look around this point, it doesn't look symmetric. That's... Okay, so what I can extract from the fit to this parabola, well, if I fit a parabola, I have three parameters, but I actually turn out to have four unknowns. The central charge, the Fermi velocity, and the energy and something associated to the momentum or the charge. And so, fortunately, I can only get ratios of these things. But the ratios that I expect from the field theory very nicely agree with the ratios that I extract numerically. And it turns out that this actually already works for the six-side chain, that these ratios look pretty nice. So that's really sort of amazing. And so the nice thing is that I can do it for the larger system that I can handle. I don't have to do scaling or extract anything. So we checked that it worked for the one-dimensional chain, and then we wanted to study these ladder-like systems that are obtained from the square lattice by imposing doubly periodic boundary conditions in these ways. And so basically our aim was to try and get some understanding for what is going on in the square lattice, so hope to be able to extrapolate from these small system sizes to the full 2D case. And so we included a case where you have the full window of fillings of ground states, and a case which is really more two-dimensional because the particles can hop past each other in this ladder. And so this is just another of these spectral flow plots. So again, you recognize a nice parabola. And here are the values that were expected. So the three different systems with the number of sites and the number of particles, and then again these ratios that we could extract. And if you stare at it long enough, you recognize certain combinations of values. And they exactly correspond with with some of the values that we would expect in the minimal models for superconformal field theory. That is the combination of minus a 12th and zero that you see here, for example. So we couldn't extract what conformal field theory describes these models. We couldn't extract the central charge, but it's very compelling evidence that they are described by superconformal field theories in the continuum limb. Okay, so let me just briefly mention some.
Finite using a cylinder, we get a C.
Yeah, so for this simplest case, the square ladder, we looked at the central charge with entanglement entropy, and that turns out to be very close to 1.5. So probably that's described by the second conformal minimal model. Okay, so of course we can try to study a lattice model and then see what the ground state degeneracy is, but we can also try to get something that we would like to get. And so here's an example of a lattice that nicely accommodates this three rule. Remember that the frustration arises because there's many ways that these particles can be approximately three sides apart. But this lattice sort of reduces the frustration, and in fact, in the absence of any of these triangles, there's a unique lowest energy state. But then for each triangle, it turns out that I get a twofold degeneracy of the ground state. And so by controlling the number of triangles that I add, I can actually control the ground state degeneracy. And we've looked at what possible scalings of the entanglement entropy this could give rise to, and could give anomalous violations of the area law. And so another thing that we've been doing is including a staggering. So including some coefficients in the supercharges doesn't break the supersymmetry, so we're free to do that. And we can choose those to be just one on one sublattice and y on another sublattice in such a way that can reveal something about this ground state. So in certain limits where you take y to be very small, the cohomology elements that you've computed actually become the ground state. And so then you can learn something from studying this and understand some simple limits. And so we're also trying to understand the square lattice by doing this technique.
You can pick a sign if you want.
Yes.
But,
yeah.
I mean, as long as
you. Yes. Yeah, and so the reason to do two is because that's the way we compute the cohomology. We use the tic-tac-toe lemma, where you... The tic-tac-toe lemma.
Here I'm lost. I'm being watching television.
Yeah, I guess the name is already sort of a reason to want to know what it is, right? Because, so that tells you that the cohomology of the supercharge, if you can write it as the sum of two supercharges, a Q1 and a Q2, that the cohomology of Q can be will be contained in the cohomology of Q2 acting on the cohomology of Q1. So you can reduce your computation.
But you can, I mean, if it's a sum of three of them, then it's less.
Yeah. But it turns out that that usually doesn't help you. Okay, yeah, so finally, before I conclude, or yeah, maybe this is my conclusion. So there's of course lots of open questions that I've already mentioned throughout the talk, but there's also maybe interesting connections to your community. And I've already been thinking a little bit about possible connection to ADS-CMT, where the gauge gravity duality is applied to condensed matter systems. Could this model maybe be a toy model? Because it has some of the features that typically arise there, such as an extensive ground state entropy and also supersymmetry. Of course, it doesn't have large n, which may be a problem, but another open problem is what are the continuum theories for the 2D systems? And is there maybe emergent gauge symmetry, or can we somehow include that on the lattice? So that's maybe something that I can learn from you. How I might do that, and other possible things that you want to tell me, I would be happy to hear about. And yeah, so basically this is what I've tried to convince you of, that supersymmetry has helped us to study this intermediate density regime of this model. Thanks for your time.
One-dimensional chain. What symmetry does it have? Is it SU2/2? Can you specify the symmetry algebra?
So it's the first superconformal minimal model.
I mean, on level of the chain in this discretized version, like you have.
Yeah, there's just a U1 symmetry of the particle.
Yeah, the reason I'm asking is there's a paper. Of myself and Bicek. So we're considering the supersymmetrization of XRZ chain, and it has manifested SU2/2 supersymmetry per site. So since you're considering the case where the near neighbor potential is going to infinity, maybe the limit of that case. Mm.
Actually, there is a large N connection, because the model we had with Gabriele was the large N model. So we may discuss about that later, how it emerges.
Yes.
How does grab T come in? I must have pulled it.
That's in the next program. There's no problem at this point.
So does it go by a field theory, or can you go directly from this discrete lattice model to some kind of discrete gravity, or what's the idea?
No, the idea is that we use supersymmetry to understand something about Kone's metaphysics model, lattice models. And I guess the possible connection is that I also have supersymmetry on a lattice, as this community has, and who knows, we can learn something from each other, but in principle, I don't have anything to do with that.
I have a question. Yeah, these two-dimensional models that have large geometry, is it clear that in some sense around each ground state there's some gapless excitations and it's really a field theory? Or you have to jump very far to go from one ground state to another?
So I would like to think that in the square lattice where you don't have this extensive degeneracy, that you have to sort of change something around the loop so that the ground states are actually far apart. But maybe indeed if there's in the triangular lattice there's also a tiling, this tiling would be such that you can locally remove a couple of tiles and put them in a different way. And so then you would say that these different ground states are actually close to each other. But we don't even know if there's a gap or not. So that's basically also the question that you're asking. Is there sort of low-lying models that go between these classes? And basically the answer is that we don't.
Well, because in some of the first one, we have more like spaces of vacuums, and this is a version of that, and these will tell you that they're close to each other, but if they're far apart, and we expect to see massive particles show up, or maybe there's some low-lying models.
Also, the same thing would be relative entangled. So you pick one guy, defines it the preferred basis, and then you pick another guy with his close body and see how much his ground state is entangled relative to the previous basis. That would be a measure. Another measure of distance, which I have no idea what it has to do.
Of course, when we have this extensive degeneracy, then there's already not really a good notion of what the preferred basis is. Because we
I was imagining that you pick one, whatever is ground, whatever diagonalized the Hamiltonian, that's the preferred basis.
Okay.
So it's no longer something you can see with your eye geometrically.
Yes.
But it still defines them in time, right? On basis.
Yeah. And you would compute the overlap between the ground states?
Well, you expand the ground state of the other system in the basis of the first system that defines for you. Oh, well, there is no tensor. I don't know. I think it's that.
How unique is your construction of a supersymmetric model starting from lattice Hamilton? You imagine other Hamiltonians excluding some other kind of nearest neighbor or next nearest neighbor configuration?
Yeah, so you're right. You can, whatever nilpotent Q that you can come up with would in principle give you the candidate. So the simplest thing that you the thing is from this nearest neighbor exclusion. But it turns out that in that case, the Hamiltonian just is a number. It's the number of sides. But that's too trivial. So the first sort of non-trivial thing was to include this projection operator. An extension was to allow k particles to sit next to each other. But there's definitely room for generalizations there.
Kind of continuation of what David was asked. When you have supersymmetric field theories, they have these homogeneous spaces, which are deep, then you usually switch in a small perturbation, the modular spaces are lifted, and then there is one or a few true minima, and then you understand that there are soft modes for some particular mimic. Yes? So if you take your model and add some perturbation, and you identify some collective modes or something like this.
Yeah, we have not really looked at that, but it's definitely also my intuition that a real system would, of course, not have this exact degeneracy and that it would somehow be lifted.
Lifted, and not only you can lift it, but you can give interpretation. There would be classes. Low-lying modes, which would be some kind of oscillations around 2 minima or something like this.
They use two-component field theory in the IR two-component field. it is, you know, it's interesting low energy for the theory.
Yes, but that's, I think that mostly in the case where we don't have a brown state in there, at least not a very large one, not an extensive one.
They confuse the generators.
The dimension of the three dimension.
Four dimension.
Yeah, I mean, there is no limit. So we've been focusing on 2D because that's easy to visualize and that is also relevant for connected matter systems. There are some studies in 3D that show typical frustration as well. But yeah,
are there any general features you can say, depending on the lattice type? So if it's a bipartite lattice or some other type of lattice, are there different features about the entropy? How it varies with the number of points or any general?
Well, so what we've seen is that if you accommodate the three rule, if you have some structure in the lattice that there's a natural way for particles to be three sides apart, that reduces the frustration. But other than that, the answer is no.
Are these the only super frustrated systems, you know, with extensive ground state entropy?
No, there are frustrated magnetic systems, diner models, where this also occurs. But it's definitely not
difficult. You know, I mean, whilst it's true that there are sort of states in sort of ADS-AT that have this extensive entropy, they're very often sort of they're not the real ground states, or there's some problem with them. So I don't know. I mean, do you have any examples where there are, I'm asking experts, whether there's a ground state that has extensive entropy that's known to be...
Yeah, there are some supersymmetric cases where
there are. Yeah. I see. Any more questions? We should thank these reports.